Hello, and welcome to The World View. The debates around innovation policy take up a lot of oxygen in DC, but the world is big. Join me, Katie Mitchell, a DC insider on the outside, as I shine a light on the bright spots of innovation policy and offer some takeaways for the debate back home. On today's episode, we are honored, treated, privileged to have Sean Lee. Sean is a co-founder of the Odyssey Network, a senior advisor to the Crypto Council for Innovation, and was previously the CEO of the Algorand Foundation. He's an advisor to the World Economic Forum, as well as the MIT Entrepreneurship and FinTech Innovation Node. But most importantly, he is a wealth of knowledge, and we get into all things APAC, crypto policy with a focus on Hong Kong. I hope you enjoy this episode with Sean Lee, right here on The World View. Welcome, Sean, to the World View podcast. We were talking for a while before we got started, and I am super revved up for this conversation. I feel very honored to have you, Sean, here. You are just such a force and leader in this space, and really grateful that you took the time to be here with us today.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. I've always enjoyed talking to you and sharing notes and insights and also conversations that we've had with our network partners. So very honored to be here myself.
Thank you so much. So Sean's in Hong Kong, I'm in Singapore, and we'll get to the what's become in the media the battle royale of hubs between Hong Kong and Singapore later. But I wanted to focus some of our conversation today on Hong Kong. I understand from Sean that it's been a hot topic across the globe, including in the U.S. We know it's piqued a lot of folks' interest, what's developing there, and there's truly no better person to take us through those developments than Sean. So again, really grateful. I wanted to start off by going back in time just to contextualize the current moment. If we look at kind of 2018 period around then, Hong Kong was really the epicenter of crypto and Web3 innovation, certainly for APAC, but also for the broader globe. I wanted to understand what kind of caused that moment. Why was Hong Kong so attractive for entrepreneurs? And then what began to change in terms of Hong Kong's role?
So, Katie, I'm going to adjust your statement a little bit there. I would say probably before 2018, it was the epicenter. It was one of the epicenters at a minimum. But it was probably more around crypto, especially from the perspective of trading, rather than what I think you and I would classify as Web3 innovation that we know of today. Obviously, back in 2018, things were still, you know, rapidly being developed. But there were lots more, I think, interest in the crypto asset side of things than the type of innovations that we're seeing around NFTs, around tokenizing real-world assets, around all of the smart contract capabilities. I think those probably came much later. But back then, there was a lot of, wow, there's this new asset class. It is obviously relatively unregulated. There's a lot of freedom in terms of how to play it and what to do with it. And given the fact that Hong Kong is such a large international financial hub, that naturally there were lots of people with extreme intelligence in financial engineering that got very excited and interested into the space and thereby moving into crypto. And that drove a lot of activities, especially with the crypto exchanges. I mean, you look at the likes of Bitfinex, BitMax, Crypto.com, and a few others that let's not name them right now. But many of them started right here in Hong Kong, at least as an operating hub and as a domicile in the beginning. Now, obviously, later on, things have dramatically changed. But I would say, you know, back in the 2017-2018 range, it was mostly because of that. It was just an easy place to do business, very strong financial hub, lots of financial kind of engineering talent to get into the space. and the asset became an intriguing point for many that are in the community.
So I would take away your comments as key ingredients: an existing capital markets hub plus ease of doing business. And that probably extends to any market that wants to be a future hub as well, that those are really key facets of attracting innovation. Some of those firms that you mentioned did end up migrating out of Hong Kong. And there's been referral to a U-turn by Hong Kong government in past in terms of their friendliness towards the sector. When did that happen? And what was the kind of broader environment that inspired a little bit more caution by the regulators and the broader community in Hong Kong towards crypto?
I think, you know, Hong Kong being a capital markets and financial services hub, obviously regulation is key to a lot of how it became one in the first place. So there were lots of incidences and activities that the authorities here were already being very cautious of. And you would truly call it, even though I know we're in the Far East, you would really call it there was the Wild Wild West time, right? During that time. So, you know, at around the 2018 range, I think the regulators started putting in a lot more stronger language around the caution, around the risk aspects, the exposure, and everything else around it that made a lot of these companies relatively uncomfortable, given the scrutinies that they're going to be under. So that's natural, and it's quite frankly, it's a responsible and healthy thing to do, right? I think we've all seen that now looking back. So I would almost applaud the government in kind of stepping in and really wanted to keep the house in order before this thing kind of get out of control. Now, couple that with COVID and basically the whole world kind of shutting down for a lot of, you know, for a long time, Hong Kong being a fairly small place, I mean, same thing with Singapore, right? Like if Hong Kong and Singapore doesn't have a lot of inflow and outflow traffic, then it becomes difficult to continue to run business. And I know a lot of businesses are digital these days, but these two places are really city states that are, you know, that are kind of encapsulated in size. So during COVID, naturally, yes, there were lots happening in the U.S., right? Lots and lots happening in the U.S. And a lot of the attentions were getting sucked kind of into the Western Hemisphere. And Hong Kong and in relation to Singapore and a few other places, and you know, we'll talk about Japan in a bit as well, all kind of went through this phase where for a few years, relatively little were really happening that were grabbing headlines anyways, right? There were things happening behind the scene to set the stage, but there were very little kind of headline grabbing, news that were coming out of these places, especially here in Hong Kong. So we had a relative period of quietness. But you know, those of us that kind of live in these places, you know, there were things happening behind the scene, and that culminated to obviously COVID, being over, not entirely over, but over, the world opening up, businesses is back, and obviously the world economy is starting to move in a certain direction that hopefully will continue to improve, inflation aside. So that allow for a lot more narratives and story and headlines to come out. And I think that's specifically what happened to Hong Kong at the end of last year, around the November timeframe during Hong Kong FinTech Week. The Securities and Futures Commission, as well as the Hong Kong MA, the Monetary Authority, issued a number of statements that seem to position to the world that Hong Kong is opening up for more Web3. Now they're starting to use the word Web3. Innovation, they want to encourage the technology aspects, the usability aspect. But then they were also continuing to say that we will put proper guardrails in place. You cannot do whatever you want to do. This is going to be a regulated space, but there will be some I wouldn't call it freedom, but some movement around how and what you can do, thereby giving people more flexibilities to try things under the guardrail. So I think there's, I wouldn't call it exactly a U-turn. I mean, the whole world literally stopped almost for 3 years. So when you come out of it and the timing, and also the fact that a few very large incidences have happened around the world and in the crypto space that all culminated towards a point where all of a sudden now Hong Kong, along with a few other places in Asia, are now considered favorable destinations, especially when companies and startups are looking potentially to relocate or at least diversify away from the U.S. And these places now become places of interest, I would call it that at the moment.
Yeah, that's a really good way of phrasing it. It's interesting because if you look at Japan, and you alluded to it, what you see out of the initiatives by the ruling party is this idea of cool Japan and the role that crypto and Web3 play in inspiring kind of a new age of innovation, investment, and even employment for some of its younger population. And there's a whole element of demographics that come into play in terms of adopting new technology. And so with Hong Kong, I very much see the enthusiasm and the narrative around Web3 with appropriate guardrails as being a response towards revitalizing post-COVID. It's hard to capture unless you lived in one of these cities, either Singapore or Hong Kong, what it was like. It was very different experiences for those of us who reside here versus other parts of the world during that period. Certainly there was a maintenance of economic activity, but there's a real push to revitalize. I definitely agree with that portrayal. So you mentioned the SFC and the HKMA. There are some of us who are nerding out over the policy process and the sausage making on potential regulation for everyone has their own acronym, but for VASP,
right,
in Hong Kong. If you were to kind of distill that in layman terms for folks who aren't following as closely, what is the policymaking process, particularly with respect to virtual asset service providers in Hong Kong, and the approximate timeline for some of that?
I think let's touch on the timeline for a bit. I think the timeline is looking to be, you know, early and mid-summer to have a clear definition and classification around what those are. I don't know, honestly, whether they're going to push everything out at the same time, or they're going to go in tranches and thereby allowing the industry and the community at large to digest and continue to consult and continue to evolve from that point on. I would anticipate the first batches to come out probably in the June timeframe, which is obviously coming up pretty quickly.
Very soon, yeah.
And then at the same time, I think we'll have a few additional narratives around that. And then I think towards Hong Kong FinTech Week, which is later in the year, there'll be much more, because they'll have probably by then, probably 4 months of continuing feedback loop and then continuing interest, the queuing process for new licensees that are coming into Hong Kong. Like, they're going to be learning a lot from that regard. And of course, depending on where the entire world is going, you know, they're obviously also paying very, very, very close attention to what the MAS is doing in Singapore, GFSA doing in Japan and Dubai with VARA, Mika, obviously the continuing development there. So all of these agencies are all talking, right?
Of course, they're all
looking at what are some of the things that they can mimic, what are some of the things that they must take a hard line on, and then what are some of those attractive aspects that they can potentially push a little bit further than the others, thereby attracting more capital to come into the community, and thereby hoping they'll have a leg up. So I don't anticipate Hong Kong to be doing things too differently from that regard. But so far, you can see the way they're looking at it isn't just coming up with only guidelines. What they're also looking at is a more holistic approach. So on the 28th of April, there was a private roundtable that the authorities were running, inviting banks within the industry to actually come and to have a consultation sessions around what are the onboarding requirements, what are the restrictions, what are things that you absolutely cannot do, and what are things that you would like to do, but you want to get some clarity from the authority. And I think the authority was trying to get feedback from the banking industry as well. Now, the the weed out, I would say, from some of those conversations have been positive, right? There is a willingness to have this direct conversation. Because if you think about it, even if you have what would be deemed to be more progressive regulation and policies here, but if you can't open an account, well, then how is that different than, honestly, what's happening in the U.S. right now, right? It's not all that different.
Totally, yeah.
You want to stay, you want to build a business, you need bank accounts, you need all of the professional services to support you, so accounting, auditing, legal, and all of that, right? You need the ecosystem. And then, obviously, you need the you need the larger institutions that are also looking into digital assets and then trying to play all of that together. That's how you create a holistic environment. Right. So I think the authorities here have kind of learned from what happened before, from other jurisdictions, and really trying to look at a holistic picture. And that's what I would say is, to me, for someone who's being in the industry, who's building and also doing some regulatory work, to me, that's responsible. Right.
Absolutely.
That's not looking at one side, but looking at multiple different portions and trying to push everything forward. In a holistic manner. And I think that's, to be someone here and living here, I'd love to see that.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the kind of special elements of being in these hyper hub markets that are just concentrated by geography and design, everyone's neighbor, more or less, but also having an open regulator. That is, we're spoiled by that, Sean, and it's unique. Mm. And it's something that I think other geographies, other economies, including especially in the West with the US, can really learn from those types of open dialogues and round tables. The fact that that meeting coincided with a lot of noise around Operation Choke Point 2.0 and some other trends in the US is maybe not coincidence. It's probably by design. It's probably a learning, and it shows how agile the authorities are, which is also super encouraging for innovative technologies, right?
For sure. Yeah. I would just say, Katie, that a lot of what's happening that we see on the news and Bloomberg and otherwise, especially about the US, we may think that it is regulatory driven. And there's obviously a few key people that that the community continue to point fingers at.
Yes.
And, for the right reasons. But it's not the entire truth, to be honest, right?
I agree with
you. A lot of this is very political, right? And I know we don't want to put a political brush on everything. But in a market like that, it is extremely political. So, if you were to ask me, do I think it's going to be solved with better regulatory kind of clarity? I think obviously that will help, but it doesn't change the macro environment, both from an economic perspective and also from a political perspective. So this thing will get much more to get unwind. Than otherwise. And it's, I'm obviously watching with great interest, even though I'm in this part of the world, but obviously all of the projects that we do are global in nature. And you can't ignore the fact that there are still lots of activities and innovation that are happening all around the world, and you got to keep an eye on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's political. And then also there's probably motives and incentives of some of those incumbent financial institutions that are a little bit misaligned with some of the more disruptive facets of financial technology. And so we have to bear that in mind as well. But I still think it's commendable that we have these sort of open dialogues, especially in markets like Hong Kong. And I think it bodes really well for industry. I wanted to pivot a little bit to Hong Kong's role in the region. First, the one thing that one of many things that makes Hong Kong so attractive, besides what you've outlined earlier, is this idea that it's really a bridge to the giant economic power that is mainland China. And so I wanted to see if we could talk a little bit about the role of Hong Kong vis-a-vis mainland China, especially given where policy is there with respect to crypto. And is it true or fair to say that Hong Kong could serve as a potential bridge for crypto activity for those interested in mainland?
Okay, so let's put it this way. Hong Kong is not only a bridge to mainland China, but it is also a bridge towards the U.S. economy, right? If you think about it truly, there is a reason why the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the U.S. dollar, and that's not really going any away anytime soon. And the fact that the U.S. continue to serve as a global reserve currency and a trade currency as well, and obviously there's lots of kind of de-dollarization activities that are happening now. We can talk about that later in a little bit. But Hong Kong basically have a currency that is pegged to the U.S. dollar, which is the largest economy in the world. And then Hong Kong have established capital requirements and capital rules, inflow and outflow in and out of mainland China, the second largest economy in the world. So there's really no other place in the world that have this kind of characteristic that also is a very strong capital markets and financial services hub that have access to both economies. This is a very, very unique place. That's also why Hong Kong has always been a very special place over the last few decades in terms of how it conducts business and how it becomes a bridge towards other economies around the world, not just China and the US. In the notion of digital asset, though, you would probably think that when we talk about crypto, too often I think we just look at crypto asset, right? And we look at these crypto tokens that are created on chain. Some of them are utility centric. Some of them are representation of other things. Some of them based on nothing. I mean, I was on a podcast the other day, and the host keeps wanting to talk about Pepe, the meme coin.
Gosh, yeah.
Let's leave those aside. But you've got crypto assets. But in the greater scheme of digital assets, you have crypto assets that are on chain. You have tokenized assets that may or may not represent real world assets that's continuing to pop up. Then you have stable coins. Right, and increasingly more so now, potentially different currency pegged stable coins. We're already seeing the euro that are starting to gain some activities. Japan has been talking about it, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, you have CBDC, right? And arguably, with all of the various developments and experimentations around CBDC, central bank digital currencies that are happening around the world, I read in one of the reports that 60 or 70% of all of the projects in the CBDC space are actually right here in Asia.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you take a look at all of these factors, they are all digital asset in nature. And you look at a place like Hong Kong, where you have access to capital very readily. It has been a crypto hub, right, from a crypto trading perspective. It has established capital rules with China in and out. And that's been established back in the 2010, 2011 times. The dollar, the Hong Kong dollar, is pegged to the U.S. dollar, so getting access to the largest economy. And then you've got increasingly more so now regulatory progressiveness. I would call it
clarity,
that, right?
Even, yeah.
So all of these things coming together makes Hong Kong a fairly interesting place. I definitely would not call it just a crypto hub. And I think the government here have been very careful to say digital asset hub, not crypto hub. And I strongly believe, I agree with that notion. It is not cryptos, but one aspect of the overall game. Earlier this year, the Hong Kong government released, I think it was $800 million Hong Kong dollar worth of tokenized green bonds, right? Which is what equivalent to about $102 million or something like that in US dollar. And these are tokenized green bonds. Right, yeah. And there are institutions and family offices that are now acquirers of these type of assets, and you can only see more and more of these things coming up, especially as larger institutions need to fulfill their ESG quota and thereby buying products like these that are increasingly being minted or created on a digital ledger somewhere, public network or not. And then you see, like Project Guardian in Singapore, tokenizing foreign exchange swaps. So, you see lots of these things. So tokenized assets really makes sense to happen in a mature financial market. And that's also where you tie in the crypto assets, especially those that are network native tokens that are used to run public networks, and be able to tie them together and then waiting for the bigger game to be played, which is CBDC. So I'd say that all of these factors coming into place really make Hong Kong, and I would continue to say Singapore, very unique places that are placed in Asia, very close to both economies, that are both very mature capital markets hubs, and thereby be able to push a lot of the true innovation that you can actually see both from a technology perspective and also now from a asset product, digital asset productization aspect. And you can see both sides coming forth. And I'm excited to see what's going to happen over the next 12, 24 months, especially given, where the markets are and everything else.
I love that answer, Sean, for so many reasons, but in particular because I think you really appropriately nuanced and contextualized the attractiveness of some of these hubs in region beyond what I think the headline often is. So I'm really grateful for that response. I think it's a really helpful way of casting and better understanding not just the potential role, but the importance of markets like Hong Kong or Singapore in terms of kind of global financial innovation and digital assets.
Can I add one more thing, Katie?
Yeah, sure.
A few weeks back, we had like a series of very large kind of digital asset crypto events that were happening in Hong Kong. We have FOMO Asia, and then we had the WOW Summit, the Web3 Summit, and then we had the Web3 Festival. It's the last one, the third one, the Web3 Festival that I want to kind of, emphasize a little bit more, right?
Yeah.
That particular festival was so packed. Like, I haven't seen the Hong Kong Exhibition Center so packed with excitement, obviously ever since, before COVID. And the interesting thing about that festival is that there were, I would say it was probably 90%. That were participated by crypto or blockchain projects from mainland China.
Interesting.
It's probably about 90%. Now, compared to the other conferences, obviously the audience were different, the organizers were different, so you attract a certain different crowd. But when I went to the Web3 Festival and see that it was Mandarin being spoken on the exhibition floor, which is already quite different. And then you have lots of these projects that are from Shanghai, from Beijing, from Chengdu, and from different parts. And one would think that the headline has always been crypto is dead in China. There's got to be no one touching crypto at all. Well, that's far from the truth, right? There are still lots of projects being developed. There are still lots of innovations that are being created. Blockchain is being used in China more than ever. But of course, these people are not launching token projects in China, right? Obviously, that is now against the rule. So thereby, they're looking for other places where they can do the business, where the development and research continue to be out of China. That's an interesting development. Now, I don't know where that's going to go, to be honest. There's always some sensitivity towards anything that has to do with China, because it's not obvious to many of us that are that come from kind of the Western side of the world. But it is very good to see there were so many projects that were trying to get visibility, get access to capital, but more importantly, trying to test out whether this new digital asset hub is the place to be, or do they go to Dubai, or do they go somewhere else? And I wanted to bring that up because we like to think there's no crypto in China. That is just so far from the truth.
Yeah, and that's such a good metric of crypto enthusiasm, broader kind of like DLT blockchain enthusiasm, because I think we often look at sentiment through a pretty one-dimensional lens, which is where is the trading activity. And obviously there's a huge kind of tilt of scale because it depends on the hospitality or messing up my words here, but the receptiveness of the regulator, more or less, right, as to whether there can be trading activity. But if you look at innovation being born out of, that's a really interesting metric or way of evaluating interest and appetite around a particular sector. So yeah, I really appreciate that insight. That's fascinating. I wanted to kind of quickly think about Hong Kong and kind of APAC in context of what's happening globally. And you alluded to this, but I know that in addition to those events that you mentioned in Hong Kong, you are also in the US. And before we hopped on and started recording, you mentioned some of the things that you heard in the US. And so I was curious, How do you think the sentiment is comparatively between what we're seeing here in region and in Hong Kong versus the US? And how are US companies thinking about Asia perhaps differently because of that different sentiment?
So I think I was mentioning earlier before the recording that I just came back from Consensus, right? And it was a great event, met many of the network partners and key contacts. And as I was walking through the venue and I was kind of, you know, eavesdropping or listening in on some of the panels from literally around the entire space, I continually hear the word Hong Kong being mentioned here and Hong Kong there, Hong Kong there. I know, like in the morning keynote, even Jeremy Allaire was talking about, you know, Hong Kong was one of the places that he was kind of mentioning during his keynote. So that's obviously it caught my attention to be sure. But at the same time, you can also start to get a sense of the sentiment. Now, the conferences that I talk about here in Hong Kong a few weeks back and Consensus, like very fresh in my mind, honestly, all of these conferences were talking about regulation. They were all talking about regulation and they were all talking about banking, right? Yeah. So the topics were not all that different. But the narrative were indeed very different. The conversations here, especially given the authorities were actually part of the keynotes and talking and whatnot, here it's cautious. I would call it cautious optimism, right? Mm-hmm. Given what's happening over there, and then you hear what's happening here, you feel like, okay, well, maybe I could really do something here. Maybe this is really going to become true, and maybe by the summer timeframe, as these guidelines continue to come out, there will be even more clarity, and thereby solidifying the fact that, okay, this is a place that I want to do business in. That's the sentiment. On the other side, coming from Consensus, I think a lot of it was, can I say the word, like lots of complaints?
Yeah,
fair. A lot of finger pointing.
Interesting.
A lot of, what do I do now? Where do I go? And some people are thinking, oh, do I just go from one state to another? Like, do I go from, you know, what, California or somewhere else, or Wyoming or whatever? And some of the people that I talked to are already thinking, is it really going to help? Going from one state to another? Yes, a state by state level, there are going to be different policies and different acceptance level. But at the end of the day, is it drastically that large? That you should not be really hedging yourself and maybe going to Europe because of some of the things that Micah is illustrating and implementing, or do you even you want to go further, right? Dubai and other places. That's the main difference. So everyone's talking about regulation, everyone's talking about banking, and everyone's talking about domicile services and whatnot.
Interesting.
But the sentiment is different. The topics are the same, but the sentiments are indeed different.
Yeah, and that does advantage some of the ambitions to attract that investment then, if there's that clarity and a more optimistic sentiment around the potential of Hong Kong in this space or other markets in this particular region. So that's interesting to hear. I think there's a broader refrain that the US's failure will be another market's opportunity. But I like the way that you talked about diversification and almost hedging as well. I want to sort of get into a concluding thought here. You mentioned de-dollarization. That's such a huge topic. We can talk about it a little bit, but I know that you're also a Forbes contributor. Very cool. Congratulations, author Sean Lee. And I read your piece and I think it's fabulous. It's a topic I would love to walk out on and we can address it a little bit. But I thought we might inspire a little bit of excitement around the region and take our former thoughts here and bring it together. I'll just admit that I often will say and believe that if you look at demographics and sort of where economies are shifting, that everything's pointing towards APAC broadly as the future center of economic gravity in the world. It's kind of been more Western in past, but we look at booming populations in India and obviously the mega center that is China, as well as these really agile and innovative hubs such as Hong Kong, Singapore, and lest we forget, there's also Japan. a number mm-hmm. of other markets. We could go on forever, but it's just this really exciting area of economic activity. Crypto included or crypto aside, would you agree with that assessment? And what's your prognosis for the kind of role, the central role that this region will play on the future of financial innovation?
Okay. Let me keep the answer short. This is just such a massive topic. I would say let's look at a few key metrics that you kind of briefly touched on, right? You look at the population and the demographics in terms of whether you have populations that are very mobile driven, very digital driven already, and also the acceptance of technologies, financial services technologies that are already very mobile and digital driven, then you would look at Asia in pretty much all of the major economies, including the likes of Indonesia, Malaysia, and whatnot, where like no one uses credit cards, right? Like I wouldn't say no one, but very few are relying on credit cards. Everybody is doing mobile payments on some sort of platform, and there are domestic ones, there are regional ones, and then there are international ones. And they're not the traditional Visa, MasterCard, Worldpay, right? These are, you know, your GrabPay and your Alipay and your WeChat Pay, right, in different parts. And it's already ingrained into these populations that are right at the crust of accepting technologies, understanding technology, and more importantly, appreciating technology. Right. Yeah. So you have that demographics, but you've already got at least 10 years head start on encouraging the economy and the people, the population to be able to accept what's being used there. Right. So you've got this in this massive movement that is not right now, but it's been driven for the last probably one or two decades. It's been going on behind the scene. And then now you have things that are at the macro level, which is things like RCEP, right? The largest trade agreement in the world, right? It's not between the Atlantics. Used to be the past.
TPP.
It is within RCEP. Now.
Yeah.
So now you look at that. And then, of course, you look at things like what China's been doing with the Belt and Road Initiative. And then you just look across all of these trade facilitation and cooperation. And then you put it on top of things like the increasing acceptance or movement towards de-dollarization, right? So settling directly between currencies rather than going through the US dollar. And then, of course, we talked about that before, CBDCs and all these experiments that are happening. It is inevitable that a lot of that center of gravity is going to shift to the east. Now, the tricky part, however, is you and I both know, like, Asia is not like Asia. Like, Europe is Europe, right?
Right.
And now we can say Europe is Europe plus UK kind of thing. But I mean, Europe is Europe. Asia is not Asia. Asia is many very large and then lots of small countries that make up different sub-regions in the world. Like, Southeast Asia is a whole different animal than North Asia. Like, and it's just completely different. So how the authorities, the community, and the ecosystem at large collaborate with each other and come up with standards that can facilitate all of the things that we talked about, that is going to be things that I think we want to really continue to see. Because you have the numbers and you have the pieces in place doesn't mean they're all going to fit together. Like, remember, all of these countries that we mentioned, they don't exactly all use English, right?
Also true, yes.
Right? Hong Kong, Singapore, yes. But what? I mean, every other major economies, except for India, mostly have their own language. So you've got language barriers, you have customs language barriers, you have business practice areas, you have political differences as well. All of those things need to come together. So while there are lots of very good fundamental pillars that have been put in place, it will still take some time. The good thing is we're going in the right direction. If we continue to move in the right direction, just the sheer mass of usage will probably triumph over anything else. And those of us that are in the blockchain ecosystems, a blockchain is useless unless you have users and actual activities running on them, right? It's the same with every network. So all of these factors needs to come into place. And then putting them on digital rails, including crypto and blockchain, that's when it's going to become real. So this is not a a 3 to 5 year thing. This is a 10, 20 year thing, right, to play out.
Absolutely.
But I think we're in the first phases of it. Like, you know, if we're talking baseball, like we're in maybe the second inning right now, maybe the third, but we're nowhere near the middle, nowhere, right? Not there yet. We've got to give it some time.
So APAC is a great place to build. It's a great place to work on complex policy issues.
And cross-border things.
Cross-border things. And it's a really exciting region for digital assets innovation. My takeaway from
Absolutely.
Sean's eloquent comments. I'm really, really grateful that you made time today, Sean. And I mentioned the Forbes article. If you want to do like a quick plug for your other work at either CCI or Odyssey before we close out and where folks can follow your efforts, please do so, because you're just so prolific and a great resource for everyone.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so. So I'll keep it very short. I am a co-founder of a new blockchain network called the Odyssey Network. We spelled it O-D-S-Y. I'm actually the S. So we have four co-founders,
nice.
a few extremely, incredible kind of cybersecurity and counterintelligence co-founders of mine that are really building this together. And we are geared towards solving the problem that is access control that happens within the digital asset world today. Because most of the digital assets or crypto assets that are being created are quite fragmented within various different ecosystems. So you have different layer ones and layer two blockchains. And when assets are being created on them, they're essentially locked in. And while you can use bridging technologies to bring one to another, but when you have so many different variances, bridging just becomes something that is unattainable. So what we're doing is building a decentralized network, specifically focusing around access control. What that means is, how do we create a facility that can allow Web3 companies and or institutions to be able to manage these assets that are sitting on different chains in a more consistent and policy-managed manner? That includes regulatory policies that we're continuing to see, and which is what we covered earlier. So that's what we're doing on the Odyssey side. And then I also do have an advisory role with the Crypto Council for Innovation, which was formed by some of the largest digital asset industry players in the space, like A16Z, Coinbase, and Paradigm, and Fidelity, and very specifically focusing on bridging the gap and creating dialogues directly with regulators and policymakers around the world, and bringing the industry voice into place so that we can learn from each other and be able to bridge those conversations towards the goal, ultimate goal of continuing to encourage innovation, and then also to have responsible and progressive regulation. So obviously, this is very core to the conversation of what we talked about today. And I really enjoy kind of having both of these hats on, so to speak,
yes,
is that while they may look very different, because one is really pushing the boundary of innovation, the other side is like, okay, well, we got to be careful and careful and careful and careful. And sometimes people think innovation and regulation are on opposite end of the spectrum. I don't believe that's the case.
Right.
I think if you look at every mature technology that we've seen over the last 20, 30 years, they all had to come to almost like a meet the Jesus moment, right? Yeah. You got to come together, and then now you can really push forward. Right now, we're still kind of on both sides. And having the opportunity for me to be in a very hands-on role building, and then also having these conversations with the FSB, with the JFSA, and so on and so forth, IMF, even though we had a conversation with them recently, like, it helps you get a much better grasp of what they're thinking, and then what builders need to think. And then I'm hoping that we can bring that together. And this is part of my mission to be able to do so, you know, and contributes to the overall industry. And I'm very, very fortunate to be working with incredible people on both sides to be able to do that.
Wow, you're just, I don't know how you sleep with everything that you do, Sean, but that's just such an inspiring example, as well as call to action to end with. So thank you for sharing what you're up to. I'll link for folks in the notes so they can follow your work, of course. And again, just so grateful for your insights today. We could have talked forever, but we're trying to keep it digestible. So we'll have to have you back on to cover some of these other meatier topics in the future. But thank you.
No, thank you, Katie. It's been a great conversation. Always love to talking to you. And thank you for having me on the show.
Awesome. Thanks. All right, folks, thank you so much for checking out this episode of the Worldview Podcast. I've included some links in the show notes, so be sure to check those out. The next edition of the Worldview Substack will be coming out soon, so do subscribe with your email if you're keen for a weekly treat in your inbox. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, subscribe to follow along where you listen to podcasts, and do send me some feedback as we continue to tour the globe with more fabulous guests. Until then, stay curious about the world, stay optimistic about the future, and see you back here on the Worldview soon.